Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. A Wisconsin winter is often dark and some might say bleak, but it is nothing compared to what you would find in Iceland. And the Iceland of 1829 was an especially dark one for one woman in particular. In that year, Agnes Magnusdottir was convicted for her part in the murder of two men and sentenced to death. But before her execution, she was sent to live out her days with a family on a remote farm in northern Iceland. Australian writer Hannah Kent envisions what that time was like and how it affected both Agnes and the people who interacted with her in an affecting novel called Burial Rites. Kent was in Milwaukee recently and spent some time with us in the studio. It's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
What captivated you first about Iceland and then about Agnes Magnusdottir's story, or was it the other way around?
It's a good question. I actually lived in Iceland 10 years ago when I was 17 years old. I'd finished high school in South Australia, where I grew up, and I was keen to go for a bit of an adventure before I settled down to further studies. So I applied for an exchange program, and basically, to cut a very long story short, I was the only applicant for this program who seemed remotely enthusiastic about going someplace where it was dark 20 hours a day in winter. And so I ended up spending a year in this very small, very isolated northern farmhouse. Oh, not farmhouse, rather, but farming slash fishing town on a northern fjord. And it was probably a few months after I first arrived at this place. I arrived in January, so it was very dark and very cold. And I was driven through this extraordinary tract of landscape in the north of the country, where the land, which is very pastoral, you have these gorgeous old sweeping glacial valleys and these mountain ranges, the land seems to erupt into hundreds of small hills. And as we passed through this area, my host family at the time told me that it had been the site for Iceland's last execution. And I was immediately intrigued, as I think anyone probably would be. And I asked them who it was and what had happened. And they told me that in 1830, a woman called Agnes Magnusdottir had been beheaded by broadaxe for her role in the very grisly murder of two men as they lay sleeping. And that was really the first time I heard the story. But from that point onwards, I harbored a very deep curiosity and fascination with this character, which, you know, fast forward 10 years, here we are, and I've written a book about her.
Well, and this is not necessarily the kind of detail that the local tourist information center would necessarily offer up first when somebody's arriving in a place. What did you see as the attitude towards the people who lived there about this story so many years later?
I think that's what interested me. The people seemed to be, most people in the area were very familiar with this story. In other places in Iceland, less so. But I was always really struck quite early on at the way in which they would talk about this woman, Agnes, almost as though she were this, a kind of Nordic Lady Macbeth, you know, this inherently wicked woman who had plotted out this very vicious crime. And something about that always, it never really sat easily with me. I was always very interested in her early life, you know, what other social, political, cultural forces might have pushed her to be in this very sorrowful position. And that was really the start of my research, which then led to writing a book. But people are familiar with the story, but I think they've accepted it as this very sort of a tragic myth almost.
Well, and was that where you initially found the tension from the beginning of where your story picks up? We know Agnes is doomed, mm-hmm. So what unfolds is not about what might happen to her.
No, and that was always very clear to me from the start. I think probably because the focus of the novel at this early stage when I decided I would write about her wasn't, you know, did she or didn't she do it? It was much more, I wanted to represent her as being ambiguous, I suppose, in direct, I guess, confrontation with those previous sources. So it was more about, I guess, her humanity in the last months of her life rather than anything else.
You had spent this year in Iceland, but you hadn't traveled to 1820s Iceland. How were you able to put yourself in that place?
Oh, look, it took a lot of research. I think had I known how much research, I would never have written the book. But by the time I realized I was too far into it, there was no turning back. Basically, I did this book as I wrote it as part of a PhD, which was wonderful because it meant I was on scholarship and I could write full time. So I spent about 2 years of full time research looking, gosh, at everything from very dry academic articles on smallpox epidemics to Icelandic fiction in translation to recipes on how to turn moss into porridge and ways that you could treat coughs with cabbage leaves. I mean, everything. If it was about early 19th century Iceland, I read it. And then I also, towards the end of my research, was able to go to Iceland and spend 6 weeks very intensively researching Agnes Magnusdottir's life in the archives there, which was wonderful. It was such a fantastic opportunity to have.
At the same time, this is a novel. It is historical fiction, but it is fiction. Were you concerned about over-romanticizing Agnes, making her out to be more sympathetic than she may have actually been?
I was very concerned about that. Right from the very start, I made sure that I was clear in my intentions to portray her, I guess, to encourage a response of empathy rather than sympathy. And I've done that, I hope, by exploring that ambiguity that I felt she must have surely had. You know, she was a very complex woman, and all the research that I, you know, managed to do supported this idea of her as being someone who was not entirely good, just as she was not entirely bad. So I hope it's up to the reader. And I've had quite a few readers respond in very different ways to the way in which I've portrayed certain events and her role in them. Some of people seem more inclined to sympathize with her, but others, I think, appreciate that she may also be quite unreliable.
There were two people that were killed in the crime that led to Agnes's execution, but the one we learn most about is Natan. But saying we learn about him, in quotation marks, might be misleading. He is also a pretty contradictory character. How difficult was it for you to get an accurate read on who he really was?
Natan Kettleson is a very interesting, or certainly character, but the character based on a very interesting man. And I think that was one of the reasons why very early on I seemed to consider, I felt that Agnes had been, it was unfair that she was always portrayed in unequivocal stereotypes, whereas he was allowed that ambiguity and that complexity. And so really, when it came to writing his character, I mean, I just tried to include everything I knew. He was this very gifted herbalist, you know, a doctor in a time where there weren't any hospitals or doctors, really. Yet at the same time, he'd been whipped for thievery when he was very young. He was a womanizer. Yet at the same time, he's very famous to this day for writing beautiful love poetry. So I really just decided to include all of that information and just hopefully the reader will accept him, you know, as he is. But that it was certainly the fact that he is so complex and so interesting that made me reconsider the way in which Agnes had been portrayed. Why wasn't she also interesting?
You know? He almost seemed like a celebrity as much as you could have a celebrity in 1820s remote northern Iceland.
Absolutely. And I think I've read a lot of local histories from the area, and it seems to me now as well that he certainly tried to cultivate that that interest in himself.
Certainly a cult of personality in ways.
Absolutely.
Well, and in a lot of ways, it seems that the truth really helped you. As a reader, I don't know that this would be nearly as compelling if Agnes hadn't been sent to live out her days on this, you know, remote farm and rather had been, you know, kept in jail until her beheading.
I know. I was very lucky because when I started, when I just, you know, committed myself to this project, I thought that she may well be in jail for the whole time. I did know that she had a priest. I knew that from quite early on. So the novel could very well have been her communications with the priest or the reverend while she was imprisoned. But then, of course, I found out that no, there were no prisons in the north of Iceland. So she was sent to this poor family who basically had to take her on. And, of course, you do rub your hands together a little bit as a novelist because it introduces such wonderful narrative possibilities. But also then being able to go and research this family and to think what it would have been like for them and how their attitudes might have changed and shifted during the time where during which Agnes was staying with them. That was fascinating. And I think, yes, probably without that, the book would be not quite so so interesting.
Can you pinpoint in yourself what it was when you were 17 that attracted you to this dark and somewhat mysterious place with a complicated language that was 10,000 miles from where you lived?
You know, I wish there was some very deep reason or, you know, I had considered it at great length before I went. The truth is, the particular kind of exchange program I went in for, you asked to nominate three countries that you'd like to be considered for, but they choose the final destination after they've spoken with you and after you've completed the application process. And I had put down, I think, Iceland, Sweden, and Switzerland. And the reason I nominated those three countries was simply because I had never seen snow before. You know, I was raised in a very dry area of South Australia, and snow seemed to me to be an absolutely magical thing, and I had to set my eyes on it. So I thought I'd be in with a pretty good shot if I was sent to one of those countries. And then during the last round of interviews, I was seated in front of these three Rotarians, the men who would decide where I was going. And they were asking me all sorts of questions, you know, like, how will you deal with the homesickness and so on? And then one of them turned to me and said, Hannah, how would you respond if you were sent somewhere where it was dark 20 hours a day? And as I said before, I was very, very enthusiastic. And I remember them sort of raising their eyebrows and making a big cross next to my name. So that's how I ended up going there. But I actually knew very little about the country. And I also expected that if I was going to be sent there, I would be sent to Reykjavik, the capital in the south. And then I received a letter in the mail saying, congratulations, you're going to Iceland, to a place called Sauðárkrókur. And I sort of looked at my parents as I was living with them at the time, and they hadn't heard of it. We got out the family atlas, couldn't find it in the atlas, so I had no idea where I was and what to expect. But yes, in a way, I'm very glad.
I wonder if you felt that your own kind of isolation as an exchange student might have given you some insight into the way Agnes would have felt as she was sent to live on this remote farm.
I've thought about this a lot recently because I do remember being immediately interested with Agnes's story in a way that was probably quite unusual. And I do think there's a lot to – I think my interest really did lie in the fact that I was having a very hard time of it when I first heard this story. I mean, I knew that it would be – the weather would be different. I knew the landscape would be different. I knew I'd probably be homesick. And I was – and all of those things did have an impact on me. But I don't think I had anticipated the difficulties of entering a small, quite tightly knit community as an outsider, as the Australian exchange student. And I really, really struggled, you know, on top of the bad weather, on top of the way the darkness compounded everything, on top of homesickness, I really struggled with the fact that I was incredibly conspicuous. I mean, everyone in the town seemed to know who I was and what I'd had for breakfast. But at the same time, I was completely socially isolated because very few people would come up and talk to me. So I felt very self-conscious. I was aware that people were in the same room looking over, speaking in Icelandic about me. I had no idea what they were saying. And I really, really struggled. And I think at the time that I heard the story, just the very few basic facts of Agnes's life, there was something in her own story of being conspicuous, yet socially isolated, and being alienated, and probably being very lonely in exactly the same place that I was then, that would have resonated with me. And I think that's probably the heart of why I never really forgot her story.
Do you feel like you owed something to Agnes, that you had a responsibility to tell this story in a certain way?
Yes, I think every historical novelist has certain responsibilities. I was very towards the past to ensuring that they get their facts right. I was very aware of my own status even in the years afterwards. Even after I'd embraced Iceland and learnt the language and had a wonderful time there, I was still very aware of the fact that I was an Australian writing about a country that's not my own, about a time that I was utterly familiar with. And I felt an obligation to Agnes to ensure that I didn't go too far in the other direction. You know, I didn't want to portray her as a monster and support this common representation of her as this sort of stereotype again. But I didn't want to go too far in the other direction and make her so sympathetic that it was just as bad, you know, two sides of the same coin, basically. So I did feel that I owed it to her to do my research, to make sure I got my facts right, to understand the world that she was living in and that particular society, and then, I guess, work from there. So whenever I encountered a fact or whenever I knew something, that was unaffected by bias or wasn't contradicted by another source, I made myself stick to it in the book. So everything that is imagination in this book is also suggested by that broader research into Iceland. That was very important to me, actually. I didn't want to annoy any Icelanders.
Do you feel like you have a greater insight at this point, maybe after this process, into what would make someone go so far as to do the things or be a part of the things that Agnes did or was a part of?
I do. And in some ways, I'm not surprised by what I learned. I mean, I always had this very strong intuitive feeling that Agnes was involved in this crime, and there's no doubt that she was involved, and even if she were tried to this day, she'd still be found guilty of something. I always knew that, but I always had this very strong sense that it wasn't because of inherent monstrosity, that she wasn't someone who was inclined to bad behaviour for its own sake or to criminality for its own sake. I never thought of her as a deviant, and I guess that's what I wanted to explore and what I wanted to prove myself correct in. And I did find that. And I mean, we are all creatures of the times that we live in. We are all shaped by the sort of expected roles that are there for us, regardless, you know, regarding our gender or our class. And Agnes's life, in many ways, her tragic fate was not necessarily caused by it, but there were certain factors that contributed to her being in this very sad situation. And they included things that I discovered, such as illegitimacy, a lack of a family or kinship network, you know, the fact that she was a woman, the fact that she was probably ambitious, and that would have been a quality of her own, but in a time where that ambition was not able to be fulfilled, which would have probably led to frustration and so on. So a lot of factors, and you start to see someone as, you know, as less of a cartoon character jumping around, and much more someone who led a very deep and in many ways conflicted life.
What do you know about why Agnes's execution was the last in Iceland's history?
People have asked me whether the execution directly led to the abolishment of capital punishment, and I'm always reluctant to say that it did, because capital punishment wasn't abolished in Iceland until, I think, 1926, 1928, and, you know, almost 100 years after Agnes was killed. But I think it was such a huge event at that time because crime, even to this day, is still very rare in Iceland, and particularly back then. I mean, even now, I think there's only a population of 320,000. So when horrible events like this occur, they reverberate throughout the community. And the execution as well wasn't a cause for celebration or joy. It was very much something that people were repelled by, and I think disgusted. As much as they might have been repelled and disgusted by Agnes, I don't think they were necessarily supportive of her death either.
Hannah Kent, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Australian writer Hannah Kent's novel is called Burial Rites, published by Little Brown and Company. Kent is also co-founder and director of an Australian literary magazine called Kill Your Darlings. She was in Milwaukee last week for a reading at Boswell Book Company. That's the Friday edition of Lake Effect. We're produced by Dan Harmon, Bonnie North, and Stephanie Lecce, with incredible support from Nathan Royster and Eleanor Peterson. John Strelecki is our studio engineer. I'm Mitch Dyke. Looks like it might be a damp weekend, perfect for spending some time with your radio. Lake Effect Weekend airs Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3, right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.